Welcome to Ask the Investigator, brought to you by the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology. The JDD podcast illuminates timely scientific content through thoughtful discussion with top dermatology authors. Subscribe to the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology at jddonline.com to browse the current issue and evidence-based peer-reviewed archives.
Welcome back to the latest episode of the JDD podcast, Ask the Investigator. I'm your host, Dr. Adam Friedman, professor and chair of dermatology at the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. We have a two-for-one deal today. Our guests are Dr. Vishal Patel and Kennedy Sun, and we'll be discussing their recent paper published in the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology, Utility of Artificial Intelligence in Patient Education, an Appraisal of Most Surgery Information Generated by ChatGPT 3.5 and ChatGPT 4.0. Dr. Patel is an associate professor of dermatology here at GW and the director of cutaneous oncology program at the GW Cancer Center, but more importantly, a longstanding friend and colleague. Dr. Patel is a fellowship-trained Mohs micrographic surgeon who specializes in cutaneous oncology and reconstructive surgery. He received his medical degree from the University of California, Los Angeles, David Geffen School of Medicine, and completed his dermatology residency training at Columbia University Medical Center in New York City, where he served as chief resident. He subsequently completed a fellowship in Mohs micrographic surgery and cutaneous oncology at Columbia, where he was also assistant professor of dermatology and also served as director of the Division of Mohs and Dermatological Surgery and oversaw the surgical services at Columbia University Department of Dermatology. Dr. Patel is part of the GW Cancer Center, where his expertise is in cutaneous oncology, including Mohs micrographic surgery for melanoma, high-risk squamous cell and basal cell carcinomas, Merkel cell carcinoma, and complex reconstructive surgery. He has extensive experience working with the pharmaceutical industry and in clinical trials. His research interests focus on the medical and surgical management of high-risk squamous cell carcinoma. Kennedy Sun is a third-year medical student, class of 2026, at GW University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and has been an avid participant in our department, working on many projects ranging from, of course, related to her publication, artificial intelligence, to reviewing and understanding the perceptions of skin cancer among the general populace. Welcome, Kennedy and Dr. Patel.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Adam.
So this is a really exciting topic, but also one I think many of us know nothing about, really don't know how to employ or utilize AI, let alone our daily lives, but certainly in our careers. And your paper is certainly very focused with respect to how AI can be utilized by the patient, and then of course, you know, with the patient-provider interaction. Kenny, I'll start with you. How did you even come up with this? Like, what was the impetus for conducting the study?
So thank you for having us on to speak about this today, Dr. Friedman. So my interest kind of started with, I've always been interested in like the patient experience of medical care. What do they go through and how can it be a positive experience for the patient? And I'm also interested in patient education. I also want to give a thank you to Dr. William Likas at KU Medical Center, who helped me develop this idea. This idea about how AI, such as ChatGPT, can and will be used by patients in dermatology clinics. That's kind of where we started. Like, ChatGPT is increasingly being used in day-to-day life in all realms, and it's a natural next step that patients will use it for medical questions as well. I got in contact with Dr. Patel, and he kind of shared this interest in the intersection of artificial intelligence and the medical field and dermatology specifically. And that's when we started to discuss what a research project would look like in understanding this interaction between patients, the medical field, and AI.
Dr. Patel, have you experienced patients coming in, you know, with some preconceived notions? I mean, obviously you're focusing on, you know, surgery, Mohs and the like. Have you had that interaction where patients like, you know, I put this in ChatGPT, this is what I got, you know, and they already thought they knew what to expect when expecting?
You know, I haven't seen it that directly yet in the clinic space. And I think that's partially a function of the fact that most of our patients we're dealing with Mohs surgery, skin cancer surgery, even benign excision surgeries, tend to be on the older side. And and technology certainly is a young man's game, young man or woman's game, generally speaking. That this is certainly is broad strokes generalization, but so I don't think it's something that we're seeing right now in the clinic, but that doesn't mean I think it's going to be something that all of us as clinicians are going to see in the near future. And we're seeing the applications, like you brought up the topic, this topic, Dr. Friedman, and mentioned where did this come from. And part of it is because artificial intelligence, it's exploding. Everything we look at is being touched by artificial intelligence. And so it's a very relevant topic for us to think about, but it certainly is a topic that I think a lot of us not really sure what to make of. And Kennedy's idea here that really has taken off is one that I've seen in the last 6 months taken off just by the plethora of publications on this topic that relate to dermatology, either from skin cancer detection, screening, from patient education, from how we interface with our patients with EMR or information that's being, you know, general questions related to visits, procedures that are being pushed out to patients. This is going to become part of our practice in the next few years. And so this is just the top of the iceberg, so to speak.
And to that point, you're right. This is a very hot area with a lot of papers evaluating different facets of clinical life. You know, Kennedy, how did you go about kind of crafting the methodology and collecting the data, especially analyzing the data? I noticed there was a grading system that was used to define accuracy, one I wasn't really familiar with. You know, being somewhat of a new area, how did you kind of set a structure that allowed you then to really come up with the meat of this paper?
Yes, exactly like you said. There's not so much out about this, and there's not really standards for assessing AI, ChatGPT specifically, in a medical context. So we kind of got creative and thought about what got at the topics we wanted to understand. So ultimately, what we decided on was we came up with 12 common questions that Mohs surgery patients might have, such as, like, what is Mohs surgery? How safe and effective is Mohs surgery? Will I experience pain during Mohs surgery? We input these questions into both ChatGPT 3.5 and ChatGPT 4.0, which is the paid, like, premium version of ChatGPT, which you can pay $20 a month for. And from there, we recorded all the outputs from ChatGPT responding to our questions. And getting to your question about how did we assess them, we thought we ultimately went with two grading scales that we came up with, 5-point Likert scales assessing accuracy, and then secondly assessing, like, sufficiency for patient education. So we sent out, we designed a survey with the ChatGPT questions and responses from 3.5 and 4.0. We sent them to 5 different Mohs surgeons in the United States at different institutions, and we had them grade all of the outputs. They were blinded to whether it was from 3.5 or 4.0. We had them grade all of the responses for both accuracy and sufficiency for patient education. We thought that was a good place to start, and, like, how is the information that patients are getting from ChatGPT, how is it accurate, like I said, and is it useful for in terms of patient education?
Now, Dr. Patel, I know, you know, you've written on this topic in your editorial on practical dermatology. I know that, you know, maybe in parallel to these validated scoring systems for example, social media, YouTube, this is even, I think, newer than that. Do you feel that we're going to need to really design unique scoring systems to accurately assess the validity, the effectiveness of ChatGPT or whatever other models are? I mean, we know there are going to be so many coming down the road and already are. Where do you see this headed?
It is the wild, wild west right now. And we're just trying to figure out what we're going to do with this information. We can, you know, the merits of this study focusing on ChatGPT 3.5 and 4.0 bring up one set of really interesting discussion points that I want to come back to that in a second. But how we assess the accuracy, the validity, as well as the applicability of this technology is going to be challenging. It's no different in my mind than the clinical trial measures we've utilized to get drugs, you know, to assess drugs and get them approved. If you have a disease process that doesn't have a grading scale, you can't accurately measure the response to a therapy for that disease process, whether that's a PASI for psoriasis or EASI for atopic dermatitis or measures for HS or for skin cancer scar assessments, whether that's surgical scars from the surgeon's standpoint or patient's assessment of scar. All of these quantifiable measures had to be developed in the face of disease processes or therapies. And AI is no different than that. And certainly algorithms that are developed utilizing data that we then create an algorithm that outputs out information, it relies on itself. You know, it's feeding itself, so to speak. So we have to be thoughtful and critical about, is this addressing the need that we have? And so one of the points here, not only about the accuracy and the sufficiency of the answers, but what I found interesting was the responses we were getting and the grade level, the reading grade level of those responses may be the more challenging piece as we potentially use that or roll that out in clinical practice, thinking about the patients and whether can they understand and get from the information that's automated what we want them to get. And these are much more kind of philosophical, esoteric questions that we're going to have to spend a lot of time in making sure that the technology does what we want it to do and not create a more, as Kennedy highlighted, what the patient experience is actually going to be like. We may think this made logical sense, but we could understand that patients may feel the opposite effect potentially by feeling more alienated if they can't understand the information or it feels more overwhelming, just like when somebody searches Dr. Google and they see the worst images of a disease process, immediately think that that's what's going to happen to them. And we need to be able to filter that and provide them some guidance and structure for that information.
Well said.
If I may say one thing about that Dr. Patel was mentioning, in terms of the grading, we use the Fleisch-Kincaid grade level assessment to assess all of the outputs from ChatGPT. And the grade level, the reading grade level was about a high school experience or entering college reading level. So we need to think about how that affects the patients. Who is reading this information? Is that the reading level that we want this medical information to be delivered at? And also something that's really interesting about these generative AI languages is that they differ day to day. It can be really hard to create a standardized assessment because a question that you ask ChatGPT one day, they could give you a different answer on one day versus the next week, next year. So it's hard to kind of pin down an ever evolving dynamic system. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, no, it sounds like more questions than answers. And I think you both have kind of alluded to what the answer is to this next question, which is, what were your findings? It sounds like you've already been kind of leaning into the issues that arose from these analyses.
Yeah, I can talk a little about our results. So we had 5 different Mohs surgeons, like I said, assess the ChatGPT responses to these common patient questions. For ChatGPT 3.5, we don't need to get so deep into the details, but on a 5-point scale, the average accuracy was a 4.15, and the sufficiency for patient education was 3.72. For ChatGPT 4, the accuracy was 4.17, and the sufficiency was 3.97. These are really similar, as you might be able to tell, and notably, there was no statistical difference in accuracy nor sufficiency for patient education in the free versus paid versions. So we thought that was encouraging that this wouldn't be exacerbating any socioeconomic differences in access to AI languages. Another noteworthy thing that we found from the outputs from ChatGPT was that about 70% of the responses from ChatGPT referred the user to consult with a physician. So I think ChatGPT itself was kind of acknowledging the limitations of its ability to answer these questions. And we thought, we agree with that. There's a limitation to what ChatGPT can provide to these medical questions. So those are some of our takeaways from this study.
Yeah. So Dr. Patel, from the data generated, how do you think yourself and other Mohs surgeons can utilize this data? Does it change anything with respect to educational materials, conversations you have maybe during the consult, or even how you educate your team to prepare the patient for surgery? Or are we still at a stage, your point about what is your demographic, your general demographic for those who are coming in? Is it not relevant for them yet? But looking down the road, this is something we're going to have to address.
I think it's more so the latter from a practical element piece, just again, thinking about the patients who at this current time point are more likely to be potentially utilizing this. I feel that the results and the publication we have here was used as an exercise, an easy exercise, because these are the common questions that patients have when it relates to surgery, and it addresses the fact that many clinicians, academic or private practice, community-based clinicians deal with when referring patients for surgery. Is patients have questions, and does this bog down the clinic of having to answer those questions and see a patient or just get them into the surgery? And everybody's different. Some patients don't want to come in, others do. So this addressed this that practical problem. But I saw this, and Kennedy rightfully pointed out that this is just meant to be an exercise to answer this question about the use of technology, and it is evolving. I think that as our listeners may be thinking of how I may implement this into our practice, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. And I'll highlight the fact that or build upon what Kennedy said, that the answers from ChatGPT 3.5 and 4.0 may change as the algorithms, the models learn and are taking more information from their educational sources, you know, online or whatnot. But there's also other tools out there. Dr. Jesse Lewin and Neil J. Roth have just completed a similar exercise and have just submitted manuscript working with myself, Dr. Ruiz, Dr. Alam, Dr. Golda, Dr. Nitt, from various, Dr. Truffant, Mohs surgeons at various academic centers, with a very similar exercise, but now looking at Microsoft Copilot, Google Gemini, Perplexity AI. And it brings up the issue, which model do you utilize? How do we, if we have 5, 6, 7 different potential AI models or search engines that patients may interface with, how are we going to be able to handle the various different sources of potential information, and as a result, the different outputs, the different information that's being put out there? And I will say from that study, much more different than what we're publishing here, that there is more notable differences in the answers being put out and the applicability. And so while our study showed that maybe there wasn't as much difference between these two models, I wouldn't want readers to leave with the fact of saying that I feel comfortable that this is accurate and not that different across the board. I actually had the opposite result. I was surprised but surprised that there was not more notable difference. I think that highlights that some of this information, maybe the questions we were asking, has information that's readily available online. But as you can imagine, as it gets more complex or more patient-specific, you're going to start to see those cracks fall out depending on what system we're utilizing. And that's what really I picked up. If you look at some of our results, there were some questions where you would say, oh, wow, there's a full point or more than a point difference between the assessments of the two various models. Maybe this is highlighting, picking up on, we've asked a question where it's sufficiently not trained enough to answer. And so if we implement that broadly, you know, just like in a clinical trial, you may not have picked up an AE in a clinical trial, and then all of a sudden the real world evidence, all of a sudden this rare but serious side effect starts to pop up in a significant level that we need to adjust our are monitoring or counseling of patients about that we didn't realize when the drug was approved.
No, it definitely sounds like we're literally just scratching the surface of all the effort and work needed to standardize and ensure that whatever's being generated. And to your point, you can ask the same question several different ways and you'll get a different answer each time, depending on how you word it. So I think that certainly a lot more work is needed. Now, Kennedy, as a medical student of a different generation than these total farts who are still trying to figure out how to work a VCR, do you find yourself and your peers using platforms like this, just like how patients are trying to learn about a procedure or a future experience? Do you see your colleagues using platforms like this for their training in medical school? And are there, you know, are you concerned about that use, if there is any, and how do you see that evolving?
Adam, I'm surprised before Kennedy answered that question that you didn't use a Zoolander reference and that the team is not going to have a meme for this of me and you looking at a computer and saying, oh, the files are in the computer.
What a missed opportunity. I apologize to both of you, to our entire audience. I've got a lot of work to do. I have to have a conversation with someone special, myself, to really get back to where I am with my movie quote. So thank you, Dr. Patel, for writing a very serious wrong.
Yes. In terms of your question, Dr. Friedman, I think medical students, my peers at GW and more broadly, are very savvy in the resources they use. Like, I think medical students refer to, like, I don't know, 3, 5, 10 different sources to find their medical information. And I do see some of my peers and hear about people using generative AI to assist with this. You know, when you're in the clinic and you have a quick question, if you don't have time to go to your textbook and find the right section in it and read a whole chapter, then it can be a quick, good way, like, to ask something like ChatGPT to give a brief description of XYZ, like diagnosis and treatment. We have to be really aware of where the information we're getting is coming from. So generative AI is only as good as, like, the information it's kind of, like, trained on. So we know the internet, all the information on the internet, especially for medical stuff, is not always accurate. So if the generative AI you're using is pulling from the whole internet, how can you verify that that information is accurate? A resource that I was recently became aware of is DermGPT. This was created by Dr. Farah Kamangar in California, who's also a trained engineer. She helped design a ChatGPT-like generative AI specifically for dermatology. And it's trained on language that's all, it's trained on, like, scientific medical language or information. And then when you ask this AI system your questions, it provides citations with all the information it's providing you. So I think being smart about the resources you're using and turning to these technologies that are developed, like, along with physicians and medical professionals, can be a useful way to make sure that the information you're using is vetted. And I would implore students and residents and attendings to try out these many different sources that exist and see how you like them, see what the information is like and how it compares to what you were taught in school. Because if we're all more familiar with these technologies, we can begin to, like, use them more day to day and guide our peers as well as guide our patients and their use as well.
Great.
And Adam, I was when we were working on this topic, as well as some of the other ones that are in the AI space, and to Kennedy's point, the younger generation, the new students and trainees are utilizing this technology much more readily. I actually queried my two younger cousins, one graduating from USC undergrad, another from USC business school, just to get a gauge of, you know, we hear about this, how much are you using this in your day-to-day learning? And it's like Adam and I were using printed flashcards to study for USMLE.
Codachromes. Click, click.
You showed me the Academy's old Crotochrome study guides that they would send out in the 80s and 90s to study for. And so I just wanted to get a gauge. And I was shocked that both of them said, oh, 90% of our friends, colleagues, students regularly are using ChatGPT or other types of generative AI resources across, not medical, but across all types of learning specialties at the university. It's commonplace to do so. And one of my cousins even said that he knows colleagues who have done Zoom job interviews and have had answers developed by generative AI to respond to or even read off of for a Zoom. And it really just blew my mind of what the technology could be used for and things that it's being used for that I didn't even think about. As a mentor once said to me, you need to find a niche to make a career for. This is not a niche. This is a whole world that is going to have many, many different niches within it that need to be answered.
Well said. Lots of opportunity. So I guess the question is, should I not be using ChatGPT to do my taxes?
Maybe not.
better change my passwords. So lastly, I want to pivot a little bit. And I want to touch on mentorship. And for the audience, if you've only been half listening, you still probably have not missed that there is a wonderful collaborative relationship here between Dr. Patel and Kennedy. And as an aside, when first formulating this podcast and I reached out to Dr. Patel to review this paper, the first response was, Kennedy needs to be part of this. I want her in it. And I think that paying it forward and putting your people in the spotlight is such a great example of good mentorship. But I thought it'd be great for the two of you to talk a little about the mentor-mentee relationship. I know you guys are cooking up a whole bunch of other projects. For the audience, you know, what do you see as ideals that you look for in the respective mentee-mentor? And Kenny, I'll start with you. Like, what do you look for in a mentor? And kind of thinking about your experience with Dr. Patel.
I'm gonna usurp that and go first, Adam.
Wow!
I want to take the pressure off Kennedy for having to say everything positive about me and give her a free rein to be
another sign of open mentor.
to let her be open and honest. And what I want to say by that matter is this is Kennedy's stage to speak to. She and this is advice to all the young trainees and students out there that I cannot stress enough. My father told me when I was a young student that education, your relationship with your teacher, was that relationship had over time had an inverse relationship, that it was 90% teacher and 10% student on the early, you know, early education side, elementary side, and that slowly that responsibility grows for the student and falls for the teacher to 20-80 when you're in elementary school, and then, you know, 50-50 maybe as you get into middle, junior high, high school, and then you take over as a responsible learner as you're in your university training, your undergrad and graduate experience, and that may be 60-40, 70-30, and certainly to your graduate studies, medical school, PhD, other types of graduate programs, you're driving that learning process. And it's 90-10 or 99-1 when you're a resident or beyond that time point. I think Adam and I, you and I talk about this, that oftentimes students don't realize that how important that is to be able to get the most out of the mentor-mentee experience, both from a practical element, because we as clinicians in the academic setting have a million different strings pulling us in a million different ways, from just the clinical medicine to the resident teaching, student teaching, administrative sides, figuring out how to get EMR messages to the right clinician in the right place and not end up in the wrong department is the fire that Dr. Freeman is putting out right now. And because of that, and I really commend, and that's a real reason why I want Kennedy here, is this was an idea that, you know, this example here, I work in this space and do work in this space, but the question being asked, devising the hypothesis and thinking about how to test that hypothesis and the background of that was initiated and driven on by the mentee here. And that's really critical. We can help guide and formulate and correct the path, but that ambition and that self-initiation has to come first. So many times it's like, give me something to work off of. Here's this idea. I have this interesting question. I'm interested in understanding this point, and this is how I'm going to ask it. What do you think about that? That makes our job to be able to get something interesting out of it and push so much easier than a blank slate. And that doesn't mean a blank slate is not valuable, that you want to learn. But sometimes, depending on the time of what we as faculty are doing, we may not have a project. We may not be able to develop one out of thin air to let somebody take off. So I urge the listeners, the trainees, and the students to think about that to get the most out of that relationship and experience.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And that's often the advice I also give when, to your point, you know, it's hard for someone who's not necessarily exposed to dermatology to know what do they already love about dermatology, know, and maybe this is the more important point, is even to how to ask a question. And that's really what it comes down to, is how to ask a question, thinking about questions that can then be guided by someone like you or myself down the path to, you know, to being fruitful and creating data and ultimately a publication. And so I agree. I think your advice is so important, needs to be echoed throughout the halls of academia, that when you approach a mentor coming to the table with an idea, a direction, but really looking to the mentor for what that mentor is that Waze, is that Google Maps to kind of get to that endpoint, that starts a really wonderful path versus saying, hey, I need a project. You know, and yes, you're right. You may not even know how to ask a question, and that is absolutely okay. But at a minimum, know that person's interest, you know what they work in, you know, to go to, you know, to, for example, to go to you and say, you know, I am really, really interested in hair loss. Could we work on a project? That clearly shows you probably didn't look at your faculty page. So I think there's very basic things a mentee or student or trainee can do to really set that relationship off in the right direction. And you are right. Like we do not have the bandwidth to take something from start to finish. We can guide, but really the powerhouses here are our students, are our residents, and that really engenders a wonderful relationship and also shows them how to be mentors down the road too.
And you don't need to know the subject. Like you said, does it hair loss or whatnot? This is a great example of understanding a technology. You could have applied this to, I don't know, you know, mechanical engineering, and what is the AI role of that? It's specialty agnostic to some say. So for a lot of the listeners, think about what you're excited or interested in. Medical education, generative AI is what led Kennedy to ask this question. It's not about Mohs surgery and me as a Mohs surgeon that had that link up, but that's what commonly binds us. So there are more than one way to get to that end result of asking an interesting question and yep. finding an answer.
Absolutely. Kennedy, take us home. What are your thoughts here before either of us interrupt you?
No, I always appreciate hearing from both of you. In terms of my advice to other students, I would say like kind of look inward first. Like obviously we all know the importance of being involved with research and extracurriculars as students, but I found that my most engaging and meaningful projects have come from me really like sitting with myself and thinking about where my interests lie in medicine. And a lot of that for me lies in like kind of this patient experience and like the psychosocial aspects that are influencing like dermatologic treatment and outcomes, things like that. So once I kind of identified some of my own interests, I was so eager about them to like work on them. I think that's how my pairing with Dr. Patel kind of worked out. Like I was so truly interested in these ideas that I had and I wanted to pursue them further. And then if you're able to find a mentor who shares in these interests, I think it's a natural like alliance and like a common goal. And I think for students, like I would have been really surprised to hear that I was doing this if you asked me a few years ago. But once you start trying to like familiarize yourself with medical literature and thinking about what is truly of interest to you, where you want to spend your time when that comes to research, the ideas start to flow and like research projects that you want to pursue and just questions that you want to be able to answer in the medical world. So that's where I'd recommend students starting is looking inward about what truly interests you and what you care about, want to know more about. And in terms of a mentor relationship, working with Dr. Patel has been such an amazing experience for me in terms of learning more about skin cancer specifically and just having someone further along this medical process who I trust and can communicate with openly about like my goals and my interest. I think working with someone who you're able to be in contact with easily and have a similar like mindset about how to achieve things, timelines to go through, just general like concepts of getting along with people. It's good to just like be yourself and find people around you who you trust and who your interests align with and demonstrate your skills and reliability as a student. And that's a great foundation for an ongoing like working relationship within medicine.
Well said. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for sharing your insights into this really interesting paper. And of course, sharing your experiences and advice with respect to formulating an idea, engaging a mentor or a mentee, as I think that that relationship can really be such an incredible starting point and set someone in the right trajectory that can only keep going up without a ceiling. So thank you both so much. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. Clearly, I need to do a better job of harnessing my repository of movie quotes, note to self. Thank you, Dr. Patel. And, you know, it really was a pleasure having both of you here.
Thank you so much to both of you. This is great.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. And thank you, Kennedy, for all your hard work.
And thank you all for joining us. Stay tuned for the next edition of the JDD Podcast.
You've been listening to JDD Podcast, Ask the Investigator, the number one podcast for dermatology pearls. Our host is Dr. Adam Friedman. The podcast is produced and edited by Emily Lynch Fries. Our theme music is Designed for Life by Young Presidents. New episodes are available the first Friday of every month. Check us out at jddonline.com/podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to talk to us about this or any other episode, email us at info@jddonline.com. Subscribe and review the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, and don't forget to catch our next episode. Thanks for listening.